This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
As you know, we're all Dog Guide Handlers. The organisation's been going just for a couple of years now. We've got about 30 members around Australia. We basically do a lot of advocacy, a bit of advocacy here and there. We do these teleconferences just for information sharing to other Dog Guide Handlers around Australia, and you know, we're a fledgling organisation made up of consumers, and just getting as much information out to other Dog Guide Handlers around Australia. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what we do.
Fantastic.
So I might hand over to you.
Sure.
What do you do?
Okay, so my name's Kim Ryan. I've been working for Guide Dogs in Tasmania here for about the last 9 years. A little bit different from most likely your other schools. I'm the only guide dog mobility instructor that is here in Tasmania. So my role is overseeing the puppy development program, so all of our volunteers that are on that program, training the guide dogs when they come to training age, and also working with the clients around the state. So quite a diverse role, as you can imagine. I thought today I'll have a bit of a chat of about the puppy raising program, because I believe there's been an interest in that and what's involved with that, and training of the dogs, and definitely fire away questions, and I'll do the best I can to answer them at the end as well. So puppy raising is a group of purely volunteer families. So we have pre-selected in Tasmania based on meeting certain criteria. So every state school will have different criteria that has to be met. The reason why we have this criteria is we want the puppy raising program and the puppy raising of the dogs to be nice and successful. So we're asking that people work part-time or less, because there is definitely a huge commitment involved, especially in the first few months of time with those dogs, and getting them out and about and socialising the dogs so that they are a nice, calm, confident dog when they come in for training. We ask that there's more than one adult in the home for a couple of reasons. There is a lot of time involved at the beginning, and you do need to have a break, so it's nice to be able to hand the dog over to someone else to look after. But we also don't want the dog to become too attached to just one person, because then you can imagine what it would be like when it comes in for training, and we want it to be able to adapt and be handled by different people because of the training process, and then placing it over to a client. Fully fenced section, of course, and they have to have the puppy live inside with them inside their own home, so they can't just leave it outside at night, and that they have to be able to accept that they're going to have a puppy and puppy behaviour inside the house. We do provide them with a little bit of basic training prior to receiving their pup, so it's not just here's the pup, off you go. This includes some dog handling, and I really like to see them handling dogs first and see what they're going to be like and how much support they're going to be needing, and training to raise the pups the correct way. Definitely go over what to expect when the puppy arrives, because once I place a puppy in their hands, they don't really listen to me for the first half hour. So you can imagine what that's like, the excitement when the puppy comes into the home. And the role of the puppy raiser that in the development of the guide dog. So it's really about teaching them that they're doing this for a purpose. They're doing this to develop a really confident dog that can go on to be trained to help someone with a vision impairment. So they can't just raise it the way that they want. We do have some strict guidelines for them to follow so that we do get more success out of our pups that are coming through. All equipment is provided by us to them. So they are just dedicating purely their time, and there certainly is an amazing amount of time that has to go into it. Guide Dogs Tasmania is also a little bit different from schools that most of you will be aware of. We don't have our own breeding centre. We're only a very small school over here, so we actually purchase our puppies at 8 weeks of age from a guide dog breeding centres from around Australia. So I'm in contact with a couple of different breeding centres. We purchase dogs specifically bred for guide dog work, because they're bred for the role of a guide dog, looking at the temperament, the health and the trainability of these dogs, and they definitely have got a higher success rate than just purchasing a Labrador from a breeder here in Tasmania. When they arrive at 8 weeks of age, they're not toilet trained. Most likely not been for a walk on a leash or worn a collar. Had no sort of experience inside someone's house and my volunteers are bound to have quite a few sleepless nights at the beginning. So I try and keep them stocked up with coffees when I go and visit and things just to make sure that they're surviving that first few weeks. The critical socialisation period for a dog is up until 12 weeks of age. So the most important part for any of our dogs in the development is those first few weeks that they arrive with their puppy raiser. And if it isn't being taken out and experiencing lots of different things in those first few weeks, then there's a lot of challenges later in life of getting the dog to be able to cope with situations and adapt to situations. So along with all the toilet training, the sleepless nights and teaching all the dogs and getting them out, the first few months with the puppy raiser is definitely the most intensive and the most critical that they have. Most of you will be aware of what sort of puppy days are like, so there's lots of chewing of things and toileting accidents inside, and also when you're out and about on the in the public, once they've had their first accident in public, they're normally a bit more relaxed about it all, and quickly clean it up. And of course little puppies in their little coats that are out in public, most of the public just smile and laugh off anyway, so it's quite nice that the public understand that we are out there trying to socialise our dogs. Mischievous behaviours, it's all that sort of play biting, jumping up. If there's kids in the home, it's teaching the kids how to control the puppy as well, so it's not jumping up and learning all those things that are going to be a little bit harder to get out of them when they're a bit older. And we certainly don't want chewing and play biting and jumping and that to continue through to when the dogs are working with people like yourselves. They sort of get through the puppy days, have a couple of nice weeks, and then the dog hits adolescence. So this is around about 6 to 9 months, and then all those puppy behaviours can come back again. But the most important part of adolescence is staying on top of the dog. So the dog really wants to come up in the household, come up in the hierarchy. So it becomes, it challenges you, it wants to be the boss, it wants to take over control. So they're responsible for showing a lot of leadership through that time and just teaching the dog who is the boss. Ways, just little things like going through the doorways before them, making sure that they follow through with commands, don't let them get away with things. So just little subtle ways of teaching the dog that who is boss, so it's easier when it comes to the training later on. The main role of the puppy raisers is really a socialisation, so getting them out and about and experience as many things as possible. Each state law has different guide dog access rights, which was an interesting one when I moved to Australia and learnt that each state's different. The guide dog law in Tasmania treats guide dog puppies the same as working guide dogs, so we're pretty lucky over here that we have full access rights for our puppies as well. But some of the other acts around the country had different act rules for the puppies, and they're not allowed in as many places, so we're very lucky to be able to take our pups everywhere. Get them into shopping centres, schools, cafes, take them on planes, public transport, hotels, areas where there's lots of dogs around, lots of other animals around. So anything that they might encounter later in life, we want them to experience as a pup and learn to cope with it as a pup. We ask that they take we ask our families that they take the dog out for at least 2 walks a day in coat. And this might even just be going to a local cafe for coffee so the dog's learning to sit nice and calm while the handler's doing something else, and just getting into a lot of different areas as they go. They must meet with guide dog staff on request and attend group training sessions. So I meet with all of my families to begin with once a week to check that everything's going all right, especially in those intensive periods, and teach them some more things with their dog and observe the dog in lots of areas and help them guide the dog the right way. And then also running at the moment group training sessions where all the puppies in Hobart or Launceston come and meet together. So we've got lots of dogs of different ages. And that's when we talk and teach the puppy raisers about things like leadership and dog communication and understanding your dog. The one that they have really liked the most is I've actually brought in a guide dog handler who's come in and talked to them about actually working with a dog and the challenges that they have and what it means to actually be out there working with a dog. So they're getting a much better understanding of the end picture, whereas quite a few years ago it was pretty much, you were just raising a dog and passing it on. So they're a lot more involved these days. It is a huge responsibility. They've got to really produce for me some nice, well-mannered dogs that aren't going to be jumping up on furniture, not jumping up on people and not stealing food and hopefully not being destructive by the time they come in for training. they really are advocates for both the guide dog schools plus also for working guide dogs. They're the ones out in the public that get approached quite a lot and ask lots and lots of questions. They have to teach them rules and boundaries, so they're not allowed, even from a very young age, we ask that they don't let the dogs, when they're in coats, sniff or say hi to other dogs or jump up on people or get excited when they meet people. So they're right from that word go that we're hoping that we're getting the skills in there that's going to make them a successful guide dog. Of course, as soon as the coat's off, they're just a well-mannered dog at home. They go to the beach, they go to the dog park, they get plenty of cuddles and plenty of play and plenty of love. They are supported by us throughout and they're welcome to come and ask us any questions as they go along. I actually had one yesterday just come in for training, and I know it's extreme. They love the dog to pieces, and when they hand the dog back to me, I'm definitely handing them tissues and chocolates to try and get them through the handover period. As you can imagine, having a dog for even that short period of time and how much it would mean to them. But the ones that have sort of handed them back say a lot. I've had a quote just yesterday saying that their sadness cannot come close to what the vision impaired person's happiness will be once they're actually matched with a dog. And a lot of them kind of refer to puppy raising as taking on an exchange student. So you love and care for them for a year, you give them all that you can, you protect them, and then once that year's up, you send them off and they move on in life and they start to do other things in life. So I really like that sort of analogy when I'm talking to people that are interested in puppy raising. Guide Dogs Tasmania do realise that it's a huge ask for people to dedicate so much time to the program, and a lot of people don't realise when they first approached us about puppy raising how much is actually involved. They think it's just like having a pet dog and looking after it for 12 months and handing it back. They don't realise the time involved in actually getting it out and socialising it. But recently we've asked why people do it, and a couple of answers to that was that they love dogs, they want to assist the community, they want to learn about raising dogs themselves, and they know that we'll sort of assist them in that. That they haven't got 12 years to commit to owning a dog, but taking one on for sort of 12 months is a lot more understandable for some people that might not know what they're doing in 3-4 years' time. But a lot of them are saying that they want to do something for the community and do something for someone else, which is great to hear people out there wanting to do that. We've had people in our program that are up to about their 10th dog in puppy raising, and they keep coming back for more. So it's really great to hear people like that that are so dedicated and get so much out of doing the puppy raising process. So they come into us at around about 16 months of age. So I tend to monitor. It's a unique situation over here in that I am supervising the pups and also the person that will be training the guide dogs. So I can monitor the dogs when I do the weekly walks and that and see what their maturity's like. And when I feel that they're ready, I bring them in for training. They undergo an assessment at first. Now, another little side thing about Guide Dogs Tasmania is that we don't have our own kennel facility here. So the dogs are actually, they stay with me and they're trained. They live at my house at night, so they're not popping into a training kennels at night. And then we've got offices in Hobart and Launceston where I work from and where our other rehab staff are working from. So they're basically trained on the go and set up in that way and not popped into kennels at night, which I think can be quite nice for some of them because they can get that little bit of special attention when they've got some certain behaviours to be worked on. And their home behaviours are certainly worked on in that way as well. When they first come to me, I'll take them out for around about 20 walks and do a really big assessment and look at things like their confidence, whether they're getting anxious in different areas, what might be causing the anxiety, whether they're suspicious of anything, are they distracted by things, and that we break that right down to dog distraction, cat distraction, people distraction, scent distraction, bird distraction, so you can really look right into what's getting the dog distracted. Their willingness. We also look at things like social behaviour, how they act when they're out and about in a social environment, what they're like at home, have they got any separation anxiety, excitability, do they have any attention seeking? Because one thing we do realise is that when volunteer puppy raisers take on a puppy and you're actually allowed to take it everywhere, they forget to leave it at home at times. So some of our dogs really have to be taught that it's okay to stay at home and it's going to be all right. People are going to come back and look after you afterwards. If they pass this 20-walk assessment, They then go into what we call formal training. So that's when I introduce the harness and take them to a nice quiet area at first and start to teach them the basic commands. So the first couple of commands that I teach dogs are sort of forward and stop, so your basic go start, and then your turn to your left and your right. Then once they've learnt those basic skills, I'll take them to an area that's a little bit busier, so maybe a semi-business type area where there's a few more distractions. And then once they've got those skills we move and confident in that area, we'll move them into a city environment. So we just slowly build it up and introduce more tricky environments for the dogs to cope with. When we introduce a new command, such as stopping at the curbs or road crossings or moving around an obstacle, I take them back to a nice quieter area to introduce the command and make sure that they're confident with that first before then introducing them back to the semi-business and then to the city travel. Once the dog's learnt the basic skills, we then introduce them things and make them a little bit harder. So we start to introduce a lot of traffic work, finding destinations, your escalator travels, finding certain things like your seats, your bus stops and all of that, and try and get them to generalise it across the board. So you can imagine when you're out and about, every single seat's not exactly the same. So we're trying to get them to generalise that that's a seat, but this is a seat also, and try and teach them in that way of what to look out for. When you're first teaching the dog something, of course, there's a lot of support from us, so we're really guiding them and helping them stop or go or showing them the left and the right directions or really pushing them to move across, to go around obstacles. And then you want to start to back off and try and get the dog to start make its own decisions. And then, of course, by the time it comes to you guys, we want it to really be making all the decisions on its own and really taking the control, taking the leadership of it and doing everything, seeing something coming up, making the decision and acting on it. So I actually go under a blindfold and I do at least 10 to 15 walks at the end of the dog's training where I'm wearing a full blindfold. Because I want to be completely happy that the dog that I'm producing to match to a client is going to be nice and confident and be able to do all the skills necessary. Of course, all throughout the training, I'm assessing the dog. I do a couple of in-depth assessments sort of halfway through training and right at the end of training and just checking that they are improving on all of those things that I talked about before and that there's nothing sort of out of the ordinary coming in. In training here, because I am involved with the puppy program and working with clients, the training of dogs in Tasmania takes around about 4 to 6 months, depending on what other things are happening. If I can get 2 walks a day, then we can certainly push them through on sort of 2 to 4 months, but sometimes you're only getting 1 training walk a day. Once they're fully trained, then we match them to a client. Matching is a pretty complex process where we look at all aspects of the dog and you'll be aware of the assessments you've gone through. We look at all aspects of what we've asked of our clients and we want to make sure that we have the correct match so that we want a successful placement. So this is easier for both you guys and the dogs when we do that placement. For example, if I've got a fast walking dog and I placed it with a slower walking client, the dog's just going to get a bit bored with that and start to become distracted and stuff once it's out working. A slow walking dog placed with a faster client and made to walk faster, the dog can become anxious and not be able to process things as quickly. Some dogs are used to being around children. Some dogs are used to being around other animals in the home. You start to realise throughout the training that some dogs work really, really well in a busy city environment, and of course the cities that I have to work in are nothing like some of the cities over there on the mainland, but some dogs cope really confidently in a city environment. Whereas other dogs, their anxiety levels might come up in the busy city environment, so then I'd look at placing that dog with a client that's a residential traveller or in one of our outlying cities, sort of Devonport, where it's not so busy. So we're matching our dogs at the moment over here at about 2 years of age to our clients. Again, we don't have a training facility, so our clients don't come to us for training, we go to them for training. So I place the dog with them for a week at first, so that they sort of, because the dog has lived with me as well, I want the dog to transfer its alliance over to the new handler. And then once the dog's been living with them for a week and been fed by it, their Labradors, as soon as someone else feeds them, they change their love over to them, I think. So we then begin the intensive training period, and this is actually done from our clients' homes in Tasmania. So I go and stay in the area for about 3 to 4 weeks, and we get them to undertake that intensive training program. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of an overview, but do feel free to fire questions, and as I said, I'll try and answer them to the best of my ability. and we'll go from there.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Kim. I think as people ask their questions, should they just say their name and say how many dog guides they've had so that
Fantastic.
You give them an idea of where you are in your dog journey type thing. And by the way, Kim, I'm the secretary and social media manager of Dog Guide Handlers Australia.
Fantastic. Thank you, Erica.
I'm Kim. This is Rowena in Queensland.
Hi, Rowena. How are you?
Good. I'm on my fourth dog guide after trying and failing with two others. But,
okay.
First, I'd just like to compliment you. I cannot believe that you achieve all that as a single person. That is absolutely awesome.
I wonder that myself. Hence, I got up early this morning to write some notes ready for today.
I feel like worshipping at your feet. That's quite amazing. But a couple of comments and a question. Firstly, I'm just wondering sort of what your success rate is with the puppy raising program, what sort of percentages fail and don't go on to guide dog training, and secondly, what would make you decide not to put a dog, you know, through into formal training? What sort of behaviours?
Okay. So at the moment I've got about 16 puppies on our program spread out on different age groups so that when they come in for training I don't have 16 at once. And we've got about a 50% success rate. We have just lost a couple due to health reasons, which we're a little bit concerned about. So we're going back and looking at breeding lines for those. The things that would stop us from, or stop me from bringing it in for training, I tend to say if they've got three black marks, they're out. So on the assessment form, when I look at them, I'll need to have three things that are really alerting me to the fact that they might not improve. So they might have a really, really high dog distraction. They might have a really high scent distraction, or they might be quite excitable. If there's three things in there that I just don't think are going to improve, then I won't pull them into training.
Hmm.
Once they come into, so most of our dogs will actually enter training, and you see that most of them actually get withdrawn. I'm just trying to pull up as I'm talking to you our temperamental form so I can have a look at the things on there. Most of the dogs at the moment I'm finding are getting withdrawn halfway through training, and this is because their anxieties are increasing. So recently I've had a dog that when the harness went on and they learnt that meant harder work, and we had to concentrate more and we had to be a little bit more making the decisions himself. He just went, no, this is too hard. And I don't think we should be placing dogs through that aren't enjoying it.
Yeah.
That definitely as soon as the harness goes on and they go, oh, my goodness, oh, no, then I'm not going to place that dog through and make him do the job. So definitely for the welfare of that, he got withdrawn. Couple of other things that are different. I know how hard it is to control dogs around other dogs, so dog distraction is a big one that I really try and work hard on the puppy program, and I guess I'm lucky in the regard that I can really concentrate on that, knowing what it's like to train a dog with dog distraction. Food distraction is another really hard one to get out of, and I definitely wouldn't place a dog out there that's got food distraction to the point where it's going to drag you onto a street or something like that just to get to food. So I guess if there's a few little things that I think can improve, they'll come on. But if there's some real alarm bells ringing, we're hoping that we've picked that up in the puppy program and been able to work on it a little bit there.
That's great.
That gives you a little bit of an answer.
Hi, folks. It's Joyce from Queensland. It's just arrived.
Hi, Joyce.
Kim, it's Nicole. I'm also in Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
It's more a comment or just, I guess, a suggestion, and possibly you already do this, and this is something I've suggested to my school and
yes, yeah.
And thinking that they are going to take it on board, which is really good news, I've got to say.
And we love suggestions. I love being able to work with clients,
see
what they're having challenges with, and then be able to bring it right back to the training and the puppy program.
Yes. Well, see, I'm working with my second dog, and I've had him about 7 months now, and right from the beginning, like day one of training...
Yes.
My dog was showing this real propensity to actually grab at me with his mouth in play, mouthing me. And so if I was sitting on the rug, doing bonding with him, he'd grab at me. And then also in free run, he would jump at me with his mouth agape and connect with my skin. And on various occasions, he made me bleed and whatnot. Mm. And one time he got my arm in his jaws, and he ended up, like, there was bruising and there was a welt. Like, you could literally see the outline of the dog's jaws on my arm, if that makes sense. And now, he wasn't exerting downward pressure. I'm not saying he actually bit, if you know what I mean. This is play, okay?
Yeah.
Obviously, as this sort of unfolded, I mean, firstly, the trainer that I had actually said to me, oh, look, when he's coming at you with his mouth open, give him a toy, which I had to say, I felt that was quite a sighted response, because the thing is, I actually don't know the dog's going to do it until he's done it.
Yes.
And I'm not going to defend myself. Like, I'm not going to protect or cover up or, you know. So sometimes it clocked me on the side of the face.
Mm.
And my school did investigate. And the puppy carers, look, they're lovely people, and I have met them. And I know perfectly well that my dog did put them through quite a bit. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not bagging them. I'm really not. But they did teach him this wonderful game, and it was called Catch the Paw. And this is by their own admission. So the idea was that they would try and catch puppy's paw, and puppy would try and catch their paw, in other words, their hand.
Mm.
And that's where this came from. That's where this started. And perhaps this was a wonderful game for sighted people and entertaining. I don't know. Not so good for a blind client, and I mean, fortunately, I don't have diabetes, because I suspect that could have, you know, I mean, it could have been disastrous for me.
Yes.
So my advice to my school, and I'm going to share it with you too, is what I would have loved to have been able to say to the puppy carers is, please just shut your eyes sometimes. With another sighted person there, so nothing happens to you, nothing happens to puppy. But to me, one of the most important things that they're doing, like socialising puppy is fantastic, and I appreciate that. It's awesome that they take him out, but preparing the dog to live in my home or in any blind person's home, the dog has to have a baseline of good manners.
Yes.
And I think...
Because our we put our puppy raisers under blindfold a number of times when they're dealing with the dogs for this reason, because I would hear from my clients. And as I said, the working across the board does have its benefits as well as all of its struggles. But my clients would say when they're grooming their dogs, the dog just won't sit still. When I'm calling my dog, it comes and sits a couple of metres away from me and I don't know it's there. So on those group training sessions, I blindfold my puppy raisers and they have to groom the dog, put the coat on the dog, take it off, call the dog back, check they've got the right dog. So I've done blindfold walks with them, with the dogs and that. And it really highlights to them what we're actually after. What they think might be cute and lovable in the dog definitely isn't necessarily going to be cute and lovable when it goes to working with a client. And I've got the exact same problem that you've got at the moment with one of my training dogs. She gets off at the park and she just comes flying at you to grab sticks and things and grab things out of your arm, and she's got me a couple of times and I've gone straight back to the puppy raiser and they said, oh, we thought that was great. And so it's definitely educating them. So it's great to have your story as well that I can use with that and saying to them, yes, you're raising a dog, but this is for someone that can't see. So don't step over the dog when it's in the way. Make it move out of the way so that someone's not going to trip over it and things like that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm so glad to hear that you do encourage that, because, like I said, seriously, if I was diabetic, I probably had to have on the basis that he's caused me bleed, he's caused wounds, injuries. I mean, obviously, I do heal.
Yes.
I'm fairly young.
Mm.
So, you know, my skin's fairly supple and elastic, but it gives me a real fright. And to this day, I cannot free run my dog by myself, even in my own backyard.
And that's what I've been worried about with this training dog I've got. She's fantastic. She's willing. She wants to do everything right. She's picking up things quickly. But my concern is her social behaviour.
Yes.
And I risk that with any of our clients.
Yes, and for me, like, there are times where the dog's behaviour in the home, that he would exhaust me to the point with his home antics that I wouldn't even have the energy, mental energy, to even put him in harness and work him.
Yes.
Because he just, like, when I got him, he thought jumping on furniture was great. Jumping on beds, jumping on couches, paws up on desks, chairs, vanities, anything, grab anything inside, race off, chew it up, chew it up.
And
then
I'm
looking for bits and pieces, you know, on the floor. I'm wondering if I've got it all. And it's just exhausting when you've got a dog that isn't behaving in the home.
Yes.
I mean, that can be the most...
You kind of take it out, you know what you're going through. Yeah.
Mm.
No, that's fantastic. And if you don't mind, I'll use your sort of stories too to back that up with my puppy raising program.
Yeah, I mean, by all means, I have said to my school, when it comes to my next dog, the third dog, I am absolutely stipulating that the dog is to be non-destructive and baseline good manners in the home, or I'm not interested. I don't care if it's the most mind-blowing workman harness you've ever seen in your life.
Mm.
If it's not going to behave in my home, no thank you. Thank you, but no thank you.
And that's what I see social and home behaviour just as important as when they're out there in the harness doing the job.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so I'm really relieved that you do that. And I've said to my school, please say to your puppy carers, just shut your eyes sometimes. And even if you're interacting with the dog yourself, and even in play, shut your eyes. Just shut your eyes sometimes. What is that like?
Mm. Definitely. No, that's great.
Kim, I believe, this is Erica from Western Australia, I believe some of our members feel that the guide dog agencies or dog guide agencies are reluctant to challenge the puppy raisers with some of these issues that happen to the dogs while they're in the puppy raising stages. What we hear back from the dog guide agencies is, oh, well, you know, these people volunteer their time, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that point. When I had a guide dog that made a mess on the walk all the time, I was told by the trainer that it was the puppy walker's fault. And I thought, well, why didn't they get onto the puppy walker? But as you say, you know, they're volunteers and they don't want to get on the wrong side of them.
Can I just interrupt and ask from Canberra, because I might have to go, can you tell me how you screen your puppy raisers?
I've changed this a little bit since I came on board, because originally it was, and every school will be different, but this is how we do it here. Originally it was the application came in if they met the criteria and they had a fully fenced section, they got the puppy. I now make all of our applicants come to at least 2 or 3 training sessions prior so I can see them handling dogs. And we now do referee checks as well to talk to people and ask questions about leadership and dog handling and things like that. It is hard because people give you the answer that they think you want to hear. They tell you what they think you want to hear. But by actually watching them and observing them handling some of our dogs at those group training sessions before they even get a puppy, you get a fairly good idea pretty quickly what they're going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, we have got some that have done sort of 10 dogs plus, but I've also got ones that have done one dog. I've seen how hard it is once a dog comes to me to get that behaviours out of them, and they won't be placed another dog with our program. It's interesting because with the training of the dogs and going back, most schools will have puppy raising supervisors, and then they will have different people training the dogs, and then they'll have different people working with the clients.
Mm-hmm.
I've just written a little note here that our next sort of conferences and stuff, maybe this is something I can get up and educate the schools on a lot and say how well it is working here. I believe it's working that once we get the client feedback, we can introduce it at a much younger age in the dog, teach them to stand still, teach them all of this, put them under blindfold, teach them what it's all about, get clients in to talk to them, because I've done that a couple of times too. Clients coming in and talking to my puppy raiser groups and just how it can change around. So it's definitely something I would hope that in the future I can stand up at a conference and talk to people about. So.
Sounds like you're doing a great job, Kim. Thanks.
Thank you.
On behalf of
Tad and Liz. I'm working hard. I love it, so I'll just keep working at it.
I think a lot of our dog guide handler members are probably starting to think, oh, I wish I'd got my dog from Royal Guide Dogs Tasmania rather than...
Yeah, I don't need 30, 40 people moving here because then I'll really have an influx of work.
Any other questions?
Yes, it's Annette here from New South Wales. Hi, Kim, and hi, Erica.
Hi, Annette.
Hi. My question, I actually don't have a guide dog yet. I'm on the waiting list, hoping to get one sometime this year.
Yep.
My question is just about the breeding. It seems that most guide dogs are Labradors. But I have heard that sometimes they are golden retrievers or are they a cross between golden retrievers? And I'm just wondering firstly, whether you do train golden retrievers
Yeah.
And secondly, you know, is there much of a difference between a Labrador and a Golden Retriever in terms of becoming a guide dog?
I started off in New Zealand and did a little bit of work there before I went over and did children's mobility and then came over here to do guide dogs again. And in New Zealand, we've certainly had a number of different breeds. In Tassie, we've got Golden Retriever crossed with Labs, and we've got our straight Labs. And the reason why we're only taking, when I'm looking at breeding and who's coming up that I could possibly purchase, and the only reason I take those is I know that they're adaptable, and I know that a Labrador will work with a large variety of clients. I haven't researched it recently, but I've always sort of, when I was doing research about 10 years ago, German Shepherds are actually meant to be the best working guide dog, followed by the Golden Retriever, followed by the Lab. So my question about them is, well, why are we using Lab? And it's pretty much that the Lab is nice and adaptable. They'll happily go from puppy raising to training to clients, and they'll fit the niche market of a lot of clients. Golden Retrievers are beautiful dogs, and they know that they're beautiful. I actually love Golden Retrievers. There's one of them sitting at my feet at the moment because I've got one myself.
Yeah, I grew up with Golden Retrievers. My family always had one or two Golden Retrievers while I was growing up, which is probably why I'm asking the question.
Yeah, look, they've got a lower success rate.
Oh, really?
They will make it as a guide dog, but they've got a lower success rate getting through. So on our small program, we'll take the ones that we know have got a higher success rate.
Yeah.
The Golden Retrievers, with the self-interest that they have, because they know they're beautiful, it's very hard to sometimes challenge them to do what you would like them to do. So to make them, if you can switch them over to think, oh, this is a good idea, we'll do that. But they do have a lot of self-interest, and they're more of a one-person-y type dog as well. They'll get very attached to sort of one person.
Isn't the German Shepherd a one-person dog?
Yeah, German Shepherd's definitely a one-person dog. And German Shepherd, unfortunately, public image plays a bit of a role with German Shepherds as well.
Yeah.
I think German Shepherds would be great because then public aren't going to come up and paddle my puppies all the time.
Yeah. if they're a one-person dog, then how does the client wean them away from the trainer?
If they have come into training, then I believe, I haven't trained a German Shepherd, but I believe once they're in training and they're actually proving success in training, then you've got a pretty high success of giving them to the client. And it's just allowing that time to bond. So I give our clients a week with the dog and just get that dog to transfer over. And as soon as the dog's with the client, I don't interact with it. Every command goes through the client. I don't pat it until it's... so that it knows I'm no longer your boss. You're going over to there. I would say if I had German Shepherds on my program, I would be boarding them out a lot and not leaving them with one person so that they're getting really used to following commands from everyone else.
Is there any school in Australia using German Shepherds?
I have seen a couple around.
Yeah.
I know New Zealand does. I have seen a couple in Australia. I think I've seen a couple working in South Australia, but I don't know which school they're from, but I think I have seen a couple over there. Yeah.
And what happened to the Labradoodle?
Labradoodle is a great dog if you've got allergies. Again, success rate. We wouldn't have any on our program, but if I had a client come to me with an allergy, then I would look at purchasing a fully trained, suitable guide dog for them, Labradoodle or Poodle.
And where are the Labradoodles being bred?
I believe that some of the guide dog schools in Australia have got them. I also know some of the local breeders are breeding them now for guide dog schools. So selling them to guide dog schools. But I can't answer exactly which schools have them.
And can you explain a business about allergies?
Poodles don't shed hair. The interesting thing, and I don't know too much about the breeding, but I've been told and had it backed up by one of the Labradoodle breeders here that I was talking to, is that if you get the breeding right, it's great, but if you get the breeding wrong, it's not so great. The Labradoodle, they hope that when you crossbreed them, that they don't shed hair because they take the poodle on, so the standard poodle's idea of not shedding hair. If they do shed hair, then the problem there with that is that it's a really fine hair and it floats and it's even more annoying than your normal Labrador hair.
Oh, right, yeah.
But your standard poodle doesn't shed hair, so they're used for people with allergies or if it's not the client with an allergy, someone in the home with an allergy, or someone close to them with an allergy, then we'd look at doing standard poodle.
Anyone who's got a golden retriever would appreciate a no-hair dog. They really leave a mat of it behind them everywhere
they
go.
That's so true.
All right, they certainly do. It's all up my jeans at the moment. Yeah, but that's in particular with a small school over here, we will stick to the ones that we know have got a good success rate, and that's proving to be the labs at the moment. So.
What about the boxer? When I made contact with the Blind Society in 1967, I didn't need a guide dog then, but there are a lot of people who had boxers.
Yeah, I've seen some boxers in New Zealand. I haven't seen any over here. But the bigger schools will have more breeds on their program because they can afford to... not play around is most likely the wrong word, but they can afford to lose a few more through success rates. But the smaller schools will sort of stick to the trusted breeds, I guess. But, yeah, I've had some boxers in New Zealand. There were some Dalmatians in New Zealand as well.
Right. What about Great Danes? Do they use Great Danes?
I haven't seen one of them, no. You could almost ride one of them rather than have to walk behind
it. I've actually got a Great Dane, and I would not trust it as a guide dog. I mean, it's not trained, obviously, as a guide dog, but they're just so, you know, I will do this when I feel like doing it kind of.
Yeah. Every trainer that I've spoken to and every book that I've read on dogs says that the most stupid dog is the Afghan. Would you agree with that one, Kim?
Look, I'm not going to pick on any dog breeds.
What's that?
I'm not going to pick on any certain dog breeds. I'll get myself into trouble.
Yeah, but everyone says that the Afghan is one of the prettiest dogs, but it's also the most stupid.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen some interesting dogs, and even some Labradors that you see out on the streets. You think, golly gosh, that would never have made it.
So Kim, I'd like to ask, it's Erica from Western Australia. What happens to dogs that don't successfully make it through your program? Do they go out into the general public as sort of, you know, dogs that didn't make it, or do you send them to the other dog guide schools?
We, as an organisation, we don't have facilities to start training them as a companion role, or I know some of the schools at the moment are going into dogs for children with autism and things like that. I do have on my books, so my theory is that this dog has been bred for this role. It's been socialised and raised for a role. And if it's withdrawn for something, I've got a dog that had skin allergies and they would show up at very first with a little red rash inside the ear. So, of course, a vision, perfect guide dog, did everything right, but kept getting this little ear allergy, which led to skin allergies. Of course, a vision impaired person is not going to see that their dog got a red ear, and as soon as you put the drops in, it would clear up, but I just couldn't get any one of my clients that would be able to see that the dog's got a sore ear. So we have a general adoption list, but I tend to... This is a bit cheeky for saying this, but I tend to put at the top of that general adoption list any family that approaches me that has a disabled child or a disabled person in their household that are looking for a dog for that kind of position. So this little dog with ear allergies, it was such a nice temperament. She's now living with an autistic boy up the northwest coast of Tassie, and his parents can see the ear become red, put the drops in, and she's fine. The little boy didn't even speak when put sentences together when we placed the dog, and now he can, I've been up to visit once to do a little bit of a story on him, and he's now putting full sentences together and talking to the dog non-stop. So yeah, to me, the dog's been raised for a reason. If we can get them into that kind of role, we will. I also am in contact, of course, with other guide dog schools, and if I believe a dog's got the characteristics to be a dog for autism or one of their purpose programs, I will place it over there. If the dog's just not suitable for that, if it's withdrawn for temperament, too excitable or too dangerous to place in that sort of place, first of all, they're offered back to the puppy raiser, and then they go up for a general adoption list. So few and far between make it all the way right through to the general adoption list. Yeah.
Kim, it's Annette again from New South Wales. I'm just wondering what qualifications you have for your job. I'm not questioning them. I'm just curious as to how you got into that job. Sounds like a fantastic job.
Yep. So you have to have an undergraduate degree. So my undergraduate degree is in zoology and animal behaviour. And even though I wouldn't change the world one bit now, I kind of sort of fell into it. I started studying vet science in New Zealand, and I got really, really sick, and it's very competitive over there to get through the second year. So I swapped to science and decided I'd do an undergraduate degree first and then go back. I volunteered at Guide Dogs after I completed my degree just to get me through summer doing something. And I'd never left Guide Dogs. I got given a job pretty quickly. Then I got offered the Guide Dog Training Cadetship. So I went through that 3-year training cadetship program. So you have to have an undergraduate degree and then get a cadetship within a guide dog centre. And, of course, within that cadetship, you've got to meet all the standards for International Guide Dog Federation of training the dogs and that. I actually then did a little bit of a sidestep and went and did my children's orientation and mobility training cadetship in New Zealand. In New Zealand, they didn't have many guide dog instructor cadetships running, but if I had a mobility instructor cadetship, that would definitely help me get back in. Loved working with the kids, absolutely enjoyed the challenge of what a lot of the kids, especially the ones with multiple challenges, brought to the table. But then I got a phone call from Guide Dogs Tasmania and ended up over here, and I've completed a 4-year cadetship as a guide dog mobility instructor. Mm. And wouldn't look back now. So I'm glad I'm not a vet, actually. I think this is better.
And it's Eric from Western Australia. I'm aware that there's a Cert 4 in O&M, and also I think Queensland Uni, I believe, also runs a degree in
yes.
mobility. That's about yeah. all I know.
Yeah. I think Griffiths and Monash have the postgrad diplomas in orientation mobility. As an organisation, I know every school's different as well. Guide Dogs Tasmania actually is the only low vision rehabs provider in Tasmania. So we have all our orientation mobilities and our low vision rehab offices in our office here. Vision Australia doesn't actually have an office here. So we've pretty much had to develop our services to provide everything and anything for our clients. And we've just offered a scholarship to try and get some more mobility instructors because it's very hard to attract people down here, and they're going to be going off to Griffiths this year to do their mobility scholarship.
Hmm. Does anyone have any more questions? No? Okay, well, it doesn't sound like anyone has any more questions, but, you know, feel free. Ask us if you do. If not, well, then I'd like to thank Ryan for giving up her time from Royal Guide Dogs Tasmania to come and talk today about puppy raising and the process, and also a bit about the work she does, which seems to be everything.
Thank you. Now, I am actually a member of the DGHA too, so if anyone has got questions, you can most likely find me on there as well.
And we will be having our first ever conference, which will be held on the 6th of September, and that will be held in Adelaide.
Oh, okay.
So, Kim, if you're interested, you're more than welcome as a member to come along to the conference. And if you want to come and actually speak about puppy raising to the rest of our membership, we'd certainly appreciate that.
Lovely.
And you know where to find us if you're looking for us. And for everyone else, we have a website at dgha.org.au. And we also have a Facebook page, and we're on Twitter at DGHA Australia.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?